Welcome to episode 8. We have another fine episode for you to listen to for the next hour or so, starting with a little coverage about Casino Royale after Stephen and I have both seen the movie, so we'll give you our take on that. Then, of course, we'll have the usual trivia question, and followed by another segment of the Film Buffs Dictionary, where we talk about a certain type of cut, the jump cut. And following that, we'll do the best movies of the 1930s and also some of the late 20s. And then our top 6 list for the week, where we have the sort of the reverse of last week, where we talk about movies that we were really excited to see and were disappointed in. And wrapping it all up, Stephen is going to tell us what we should do in the event that we find ourselves in an action movie. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Keller. Stephen Keller. You get that? That's a Bond joke right there.
Oh!
That's topical.
All right, right, right.
That's what they call in the business, you know, like... Well, I don't know what they call it in the business, because I'm not in it, but I bet they have a name for it when you take something and you relate it to the thing you're going to talk about next.
So, coming up, episode 8. So, as we promised last week, it wasn't actually the end of the James Bond series on All Movie Talk. We're going to have a segment called Second Take, and we'll do these periodically whenever we want to make a little addendum to a previous segment we've had on the show. So, Stephen and I saw Casino Royale over the weekend, and we have a few words to say about that, don't we?
I've got more than a few. I've got pages and pages all written up, ready to go. Written in my head.
All right, so, well, bottom line, what did you think of this?
Honestly, I loved it. It took me a little bit to get into it. The black and white opening I thought was pretty cool, and then I was just along with it the entire time. It's interesting. It feels like a Bond movie, absolutely, without many of the Bond cliches, and I really liked the new darker, grittier tone. I mean, it's not a surprise that I like a darker movie, but there you go. What did you think?
I absolutely loved it also. I'm not going to say it's the best Bond movie ever, which some people are saying. But yeah, I mean, right from the opening, and I went into this knowing that, of course, that they were going to retool the series and take it down a notch or two and darker, and then we open up with this fantastic over-the-top action scene. It was not what I was expecting at all, but oh, I loved it. It was very kinetic and exciting and everything, and then they finally do dial it down, and I've been waiting for them to do this ever since, you know, Brosnan started. I love the Brosnan movies, but they just nonstop action, and this one does stop. I loved how it took its time and wasn't afraid to go a while between action scenes. Daniel Craig, I thought he did a fantastic job playing a darker, edgier Bond that's not so quick with the quips and everything, but just somebody who seems more like a real person. I love how reticent he was. Gosh.
Yeah, Craig is a really good choice. I think you and I were both fans of Brosnan, and I know you said that you think Brosnan still had a couple more movies in him, but I don't know. I think since they're retooling the series, it's important they start fresh with a new actor. Brosnan has the baggage of those other movies.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even if just in our minds, Craig looks so much different than any other Bond.
Yeah.
It works well. You know what I like about him? He looks like a guy who was actually in the military. I mean, Bond is supposed to be a military man, and Daniel Craig looks like somebody who both... He understands the sophisticated stuff, but also, you know, has been in the military before and has lived that kind of hard life.
Yeah, he looks like a guy who's been through the hardships of life, and even if he's still a little green in the field, which is appropriate.
Yeah, because, I mean, he's a guy who's clearly, he's seen some sort of combat, he's been in fights, but he hasn't done 00 type work before, and so it's kind of new to him, and he makes some mistakes, and it's interesting.
Yeah, and I like also how we sort of see the Bond trademarks slowly get born. There's nothing really overt that, hey, this is the origin story, but, you know, we see the music not come in right away. We don't see the martini thing right away. Actually, that was kind of weird. At one point, Bond is asked if he wants his martini shaken or stirred, and he says he didn't
care.
Well,
I think the point is there, he's emotionally upset, and he's not in a good state of mind when he's asked that. The point is that Craig is not unflappable as Bond. He is a Bond who can be upset by things and can be hurt.
That's good, but it seems like the scene was in there just to flaunt the tradition, which, I don't know. I hope this is just a setup for the next movie telling us how he came to prefer his martini shaken. Like maybe this stirred martini he discovers killed his dad. And so now he likes the shaken martini.
We should talk about the Bond trademarks and stuff. One of the things that I really thought was interesting is that I think it was a fair question going into this movie. If you strip away so many of the Bond cliches, what do you have left? Because this movie doesn't have many of the big Bond cliches. It has some of the trademarks, but it doesn't feel structured like most of the other Bond movies at all in terms of like some evil villain with some crazy plot and scheme to destroy the world or take over the world. And what you get, I think, is what this movie really pinpoints is that Bond is not about gadgets and cars so much as it is about the central character. And Bond is still Bond, though he's a little different than we've seen him before. But because he is the character and he is such an interesting character, the movie's able to work.
Yeah, I never once got the feeling that this was not a Bond movie, except with that martini line that sort of took me aback. But, you know, that's a minor thing. This is definitely a Bond movie. I'm glad you mentioned the structure, though, because I wanted to mention that. This is a weird structure for not just a Bond movie, but for any action or spy thriller.
Absolutely.
I said we open up with this great action scene that would have served well as the climax. And then shortly later, we have another one that's also this great, amazing set action piece. And then there aren't any more. There's one, a little one sort of toward the end that actually, that didn't work for me. The scene in Venice. I didn't really like that.
I know which one you're talking about, yeah. I don't like it that much either.
It was okay. It wasn't that damaging, but it definitely was the weak point of the movie. And then it really doesn't have a climax. It has a good ending. I remember looking at my watch thinking, there's a good 20, 30 minutes left of the story unless they end it with a cliffhanger. What time is it? It's been 2.25 hours. So what's going to happen? And then in like 2 minutes, they'd come up with an ending that actually is very satisfying, but definitely not the structure you expect.
No, there's an emotional climax, though, no big action climax,
yeah.
I thought.
Yeah, and it works.
It definitely works. And it's hard to say too much about the film without spoiling it, because there are surprisingly a lot of surprises. And, you know, I think if you've seen a lot of Bond movies, you kind of think you know what's coming. But here, not necessarily. There's a moment where I was like, really? And I was just totally blown away the moment that sort of kicks off the third act. It really took me by surprise. I didn't expect that at all.
Okay, so that probably covers the movie well enough. Let's talk about how this fits in with the rest of the series. And basically, it doesn't. You can sort of take this as a prequel if you want to, even though it's set in the current day, because as we've discussed before, the Bond universe is sort of plays fast and loose with time. Bond doesn't age, but the movies take place in whenever they were made over the last 40 years. But it's not really a prequel either. I think you have to really treat this as a remake. And now we're doing a new Bond series about the same character that doesn't even try to be consistent with the other movies, even though there's...
It's kind of like Batman Begins.
Yeah, more or less.
We're going to get more Batman movies, but they're not going to have anything to do with the old Michael Keaton movies.
Right.
Because definitely, like you mentioned, by the end, we start seeing all the Bond trademarks get put back in, and I think definitely we're setting it up for... I'm personally suspecting that some of the things that are hinted at are going to be throwbacks to old Bond enemies and whatnot, and so I wouldn't be surprised if we, in the next movie or two, we start seeing them. But I think it's good that they stripped away a lot of the Bond trademarks. You know, you mentioned, we talked about this before we saw it, that you were kind of disappointed that they scrapped Q and Moneypenny, but maybe they can bring them back in the next movie or two, because now they've really established this as a new series, in a sense.
I hope they do that, but that said, I actually did not miss them. I was surprised not to have missed them. They could have worked Q into this movie well enough, maybe not as the gadget man, but yeah, I didn't really miss it at all. So I was surprised.
No, and really there wasn't, I mean, at 2 hours and 20 minutes, it's fairly long anyway. I don't know if there's anywhere that it would have been called for him to be in the script.
Probably not, yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised to see him come back in a reimagined form in the next movie or two.
I hope so.
Okay, so overall, I mean, I think just as an action movie, this works. If you're not familiar with a Bond movie, I think it'll still be a lot of fun, though it's definitely more interesting if you are, and so you get some of the throwaway jokes and stuff.
Actually, I would say even if you're absolutely not a Bond fan, as in you dislike the James Bond movies, I think there's a good chance you'll like this one, because it does away with some of the misogyny, without really compromising the Bond character, but the movie itself gets rid of some of that. It gets rid of the real gloss and gadgety stuff that might turn off people as well. And, you know, if you like modern action movies that are a little gritty and, gosh, I don't know how to describe it, but I can well imagine somebody who's turned off by the previous 20 Bond movies liking this one.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with the care the creators of the franchise, the people who are shepherding the franchise, have really shown in keeping this a good series and keeping it going and alive. We should also mention we were kind of slamming director Martin Campbell beforehand, but...
Yeah, sorry, Martin. It turns out you can do low-key stuff after all. I was very impressed. I think it's his best movie to date.
Oh, yeah, without question.
You mentioned the series is being taken good care of by these producers. By the way, it's the same producers we've had all along, Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Broccoli, but it's a new company. Sony bought MGM since the last Bond movie, and now Sony produced this one, and they did a great job, but there's a little question about whether the next one is even going to be in their hands anymore. They might go to Fox or someplace else. I don't know. We'll see. But I think as long as we keep the main executive producers around, then we'll be okay with a shift in studio. But it does seem like Sony, it was a very supportive studio and helped them reimagine the series in a good way. Okay, well, so go see Casino Royale, I think, is the what we're saying. If you were waiting with bated breath just to find out if we gave it our stamp of approval for you to go see, who are we kidding? You probably weren't, but go see it anyway.
Actress Lillian Gish was one of the very first movie stars, along with Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks. She starred in Birth of a Nation and Intolerance in 1915 and 1916, two of the very earliest great films. This week's trivia question is, when did Lillian Gish make her last movie? Bonus points if you can name the movie. Now, if you do, don't say it out loud. Do you have a guess for this one?
I do, but I don't think I know the year. I mean, I'm pretty sure I know the film.
Okay, well, we'll find out later.
It's time for another entry in our Film Buffs Dictionary. We're going to continue talking about editing with the idea of the jump cut. The jump cut is an editing technique that wasn't very commonly used in film up until the 1960s, where it gained some prominence. And the idea is you have a shot showing a single action, and you cut in the middle of that action, removing part of it. But then the next thing you cut to is the continuation of that action. So if you have a guy, say, walking down a street, you might cut in the middle so it appears as though he suddenly moves, just magically jumps, if you will, from one end of the street to the other. It was used early on in film by the great Russian film director Sergei Eisenstein. We've mentioned him before because he's really the father of so much modern editing techniques. And very famously in 1960, it was used by director Jean-Luc Godard in his debut film Breathless. One of the stories that goes is that Godard used the jump cuts because he didn't have enough money to film a lot of takes, and so if he had screwed something up on a take, he would just cut that part out. But rather than, you know, cutting to a different shot, he only had the one shot, so he just had to have his character sort of jump around. And it achieves a very interesting effect. It seems jarring, but that's the point. It takes you a little bit out of the narrative and draws attention to itself in the way that most cuts try not to. The general idea is a cut should not be obvious. The jump cut is glaringly obvious, and that's why it's so commonly associated, for instance, with the French New Wave, where directors were deliberately trying to draw attention to the fact that their stories were movies.
There's another more interesting modern example that you might be more familiar with if you watch some television. In a lot of television documentary and reality shows, for example, like Trading Spaces or other home makeover shows, that kind of thing, where you show some people building a shed or, you know, a fireplace or something like that, and often they'll have super sped up shots of these people working on it, so they work really fast, and that way you don't have to sit there for, you know, 23 hours while they build this thing. But also, besides speeding up the film, sometimes they do jump cuts. All of a sudden it'll skip ahead, and so you have them just starting out building the structure, and then there's a jump cut and suddenly they're half done, and then there's another jump cut and suddenly they're almost done, and then another cut, and now they're all in front of the camera smiling because they did such a great job. So we get a sense of a whole day's worth of work compressed down into a few seconds through the use of speeded up film and these jump cuts.
Yeah, and I think we're going to try and do a little example of a jump cut. Obviously we only have audio, but the idea is we're going to show you what it's like when suddenly something is missing from a continuing action.
So why don't I just count to 10?
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, now you missed out on the middle of that, didn't you? You knew what I did, though. You got the impression that I counted all the way to 10, but really you didn't hear the middle, and that way we saved time. We didn't bore you with all the boring details of how I got up to 10. You just know that I did it, and we jump cut in the middle. Often, though, you'll have multiple jump cuts occurring in sequence, and that would sound a bit like this. 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Whoa, Steven, that was trippy.
Yeah, it's very experimental of you.
So on our next segment, this is going to be the first of a series of several segments over the course of the next several episodes, where I'm going to try to pick what I think is the best film, or maybe just my favorite film, from each year, starting in 1927, which is when the Oscars started, until the present day, and we'll do about a decade an episode. The purpose of this isn't really just for me to say, okay, this is it. This is the best movie from this year. It's really, number one, to give you kind of a checklist of movies that you might want to check out sometimes, some suggestions. The other reason is to give you a sense of the history of the movies and how it progressed. Sometimes when we look back at classic film, you see them in all kinds of different orders. You jump from 1950 to 1930 to 1970, and you may not necessarily have a good chronological sense of the history of movies, and I think this will give that to you.
Yeah, you know, that's something I think is very interesting, is to watch movies kind of in order. Watch a couple movies from the same era, but in a chronological order. You definitely get a better sense than of how things change and how movies influence one another, because, you know, the directors of a given era have seen all the movies from that era and have seen the classics from before that. So definitely there's a lot of interplay that maybe gets lost when you just get the 100 best American movies that have trains or whatever.
So as I said, we're going to start in 1927. Of course, there were many great movies made before this, but we'll start here because it seems like a good point at which there were a lot of viable choices. We're starting to see movies really come out as an artistic form. Unfortunately, right as the silent era was dying was when its peak was. That's one of the big regrets about when sound came along when it did. And anyhow, in 1927, the first year of the Oscars, there was no Best Picture award. There were two. There was Best Picture, Production, and Best Picture, Unique and Artistic Production. And the Best Production went to the film Wings, about a couple of World War I pilots, and that's generally considered the best picture. But actually, the better film was Sunrise, which got the other award. Other really great films made in this year were Seventh Heaven, Napoleon, and Metropolis by Fritz Lang. But my pick for this year as the best film is Buster Keaton's The General, which was actually released a bit too early to be eligible for the Academy Awards. The first few years, they were staggered awards years. They weren't the calendar years. So we will forgive the Academy for omitting The General from its Best Picture list.
So it's definitely some other great, great films from that year, right? Sunrise is a wonderful movie.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. So for 1928, there actually wasn't a Best Picture. And again, because of the staggered awards years, the second Academy Award-winning Best Picture was from 1929. But some great films were made in 1928, really, really good films. Some people say this was the best year of film. Some of the choices are The Last Command, The Wedding March, The Wind, The Crowd, The Man Who Laughs. My pick for this year as the best film was The Passion of Joan of Arc by Carl Dreyer. And it's known for using close-ups like no other film before or since. This film is so prized by scholars for its use of close-ups, and what a powerful, dreamlike feeling they create. Actually, you know what, Stephen? I have a little anecdote about that.
I know it's coming. This is one of my favorite anecdotes in all of movie history.
Yeah. Okay, this is a true story. Dreyer actually intended to use all medium shots in this film, but actually his cinematographer was a drunk, and he had the zoom all the way on by mistake, and nobody noticed till the end of the shoot.
Wait, is that true?
That's a true story. And it's a great film.
I agree. It's a great film. And one of my favorite stories is that the movie was lost for a long period of time. They thought that the original version had basically been gone. But it was found, I believe, in the closet of a mental hospital somewhere in Europe, an original copy.
Yeah, sure. Rain on my parade by telling a true story. It is a very interesting story. And it's just interesting how easy it is to lose such a great work of art. It's kind of scary.
And I think The Passion of Joan of Arc is probably one of the best dramatic silence.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so what do we have in the next year, 1929?
This was the second Academy Awards ceremony, and they awarded The Broadway Melody. And, you know, it's not actually Best Picture caliber, but you can kind of tell why they voted for it. The filmmakers were just having too much fun with sound. The opening scene takes place in a room where a crowd of musicians are all practicing. It's just basically an excuse to throw in all kinds of interesting sounds. But better films made that year, probably Pandora's Box, The Man with a Movie Camera, even an unfinished film, Queen Kelly by Eric von Stroheim, was very, very good. Hitchcock made Blackmail that year, which is the first sound film come out of Britain, and one of his signature thrillers. My pick is none. I don't have a best film for 1929. I don't think they made one.
Really?
Yeah. Well, if you count shorts, maybe so. They made Un Chien Andalou, then they made the Walt Disney cartoon, The Skeleton Dance. I think my favorite is Laurel and Hardy's Big Business, which is just the perfect 20-minute short in terms of comic timing. But I don't have a best feature from that year.
Well, it didn't happen.
No.
We'll just move on to 1930. Do you have a movie from that one?
We'll move on to 1930. Absolutely. The Academy got it right. It's All Quiet on the Western Front. It is a fantastic war film, very powerful today. It evokes a wide range of emotions. It's kind of the first of its kind, really. They didn't make this kind of war movie before then, where you have kind of a broad picture of a war and also focuses on a bunch of different specific characters and their specific experiences. It's a lot more violent and graphic than you'd expect a film from this time to be. It doesn't pull any punches. This was made before the Hays Code really came down on what content was acceptable in the movies or not. But other great films from this year would be The Blue Angel by Joseph von Sternberg, Hell's Angels, and Animal Crackers by the Marx Brothers.
All right, sounds like a pretty good year. What about 31? As good?
31 was, yeah, as good a year, maybe even better. But the Academy made its worst decision ever. Cimarron was the best picture. I saw this just recently for the first time, and I hated it. It's terrible. I mean, a few scenes, especially the beginning, work as a spectacle because it opens up and the land of Oklahoma is open for white settlement. And you see this just, you know, stretching off into the distance, all these horses and wagons and everything, all waiting for the gun to fire. And when the time comes, then they all just charge out into the plains to be the first to their claim. That's a really impressive scene. But as far as the story goes, it's awful. It's about basically this one man who does some pretty good things, but mostly he's a selfish nut job, and the movie tries to heroize this. He would, for example, just go off all of a sudden, abandon his wife and kids for 5 years because he's out on the frontier somewhere, and then he'd show up unexpectedly later and, you know, expect to be greeted with open arms, and he is. It doesn't make any sense to me at all, so I did not like that. And why this was passed up when you have, get this line up here, Fritz Lang made the movie M. The Best Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was made, La Chienne from France, Dracula, Frankenstein, The Public Enemy, Little Caesar. This was a real year for horror films and gangster films. And then you have the René Clair duology, Le Million and A Nous la Liberté, and there's just so many. It's a real breakout year for actually musicals as well. There are quite a number of them. But my favorite one was City Lights by Charlie Chaplin, his best film, a comedy, but a real tearjerker too about the tramp meeting up with the blind flower girl.
Absolutely a great movie. I think my favorite from that list is M, which is probably my favorite of the German expressionist films by Fritz Lang. Great, great movie. So what do we got next?
Of 1932, we have the best picture, Grand Hotel. Strangely, it didn't get any other nominations in any other category. We talked about that on a trivia question in an earlier episode. Other movies made from that year, I Am a Fugitive from the Chain Gang, kind of a precursor to the film noir era. The Marx Brothers had The Horse Feathers, The Most Dangerous Game, and Red Dust. But my pick is Love Me Tonight. It's an early musical with Maurice Chevalier and Jeanette MacDonald, who made quite a number of musicals at this time, also with Nelson Eddy. Two things that are really distinctive about this. One, the cinematography, which in places has a real expressionistic feel to it, real rare for a musical, and it takes advantage of the black and white cinematography, which is also pretty rare for a musical, even at the time where they all were black and white. And number two, there's a lot of daring innuendo in the screenplay, kind of strange to see in a film this early. But it was a couple of years before the Hays Code started regulating the content, as we mentioned before, so they got away with it.
So you're telling me this is an expressionistic black and white musical?
Yes, absolutely.
Was this directed by an early David Lynch? Or...
you know, someday those musicals will come back into style.
1933,
the best picture was Cavalcade. I haven't actually seen it yet, so I'll postpone any judgment about it. But this was the year of King Kong and the Invisible Man, another resurgence of the horror films that Universal made. But my favorite is Duck Soup, the sharpest of the Marx Brothers films. The wit and sarcasm of this is probably lethal. I think you could die from it.
Many have. 1934,
the best picture was It's Happened One Night. It was the first film to win not just best picture, but director, actor, and actress. It was the first film to do this. The other two were One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Silence of the Lambs. Other choices from this year, other great films, would be The Merry Widow, L'Atalante, The Thin Man, and Tarzan and His Mate. The best of the Tarzan films. You're going to make fun of me for that, but it really is a good film. However, I'm going to have to agree with the Academy on It Happened One Night.
Yeah, It Happened One Night, definitely a great pick. Academy got it right. That happens pretty rarely. 1935, what do we have?
1935, the best picture was Mutiny on the Bounty, which is a great film with a great performance by Charles Laughton, especially. But better choices. The Bride of Frankenstein, The 39 Steps, Captain Blood. You know, that one's actually Cliff Huxtable's favorite film. Did you know that? It is.
From The Cosby Show.
Right. Yeah, this is his favorite film, Captain Blood. However, my favorite from 1935 would be Top Hat, the best of the Astaire and Rogers films.
Okay, great. 1936.
1936, I think the Academy got a little distracted by the spectacle. The Best Picture went to The Great Ziegfeld, and it is a neat spectacle, musical extravaganza kind of thing. It recreates the most spectacular vaudeville sensation of the time. But I think better choices would have been Modern Times by Charlie Chaplin, the screwball comedy My Man Godfrey, Swing Time, and After the Thin Man. But my pick is going to be a little odd here. It's called Libeled Lady. You may not have heard of it, but it is a very sharp screwball comedy with a quartet of great actors at the top of their game, William Powell and Myrna Loy, who are most famous from the Thin Man films, and also Spencer Tracy and Gene Harlow. So it's worth checking out if you can find it.
And I think the idea that the Academy got fooled by the spectacle is a recurring theme when you look at the history of the Academy Awards.
Sure, yeah.
So, well, I think one of the ideas of doing this kind of a thing is to, after 60 years, 70 years, the spectacle is no longer quite as impressive, and you kind of look back and get a better sense for what really mattered from that year.
And it's not a bad film, but it's just, why would you pick it when there are these other things, too?
So what's next? We're up to 1937?
Correct, Stephen. We are up to 1937. And you can't say that the Academy made the same mistake twice. They picked The Life of Emile Zola, which is anything but a spectacle. It's very dry. It's good, but it's a dry biopic. I would have sooner seen in that slot The Awful Truth, which is a good screwball comedy with Irene Dunne and Cary Grant. Way Out West, the best film of Laurel and Hardy. Lost Horizon. Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. I'm kind of surprised didn't win because it was a sensation even at the time, but maybe they didn't think animation could compete well with live action, and we still don't. My pick from this year is Jean Renoir's Grand Illusion, a World War I concentration camp film.
I was hoping you were going to say that because that's one of my all-time favorite movies. Wonderful concentration camp movie, very funny, which is kind of interesting, and it really sets the stage. Pretty much every other prison escape movie has just ripped it off.
Stalag 17, The Great Escape, any number of them.
Shawshank Redemption, yeah. I mean, it's constantly stealing from Grand Illusion. If you haven't seen it and you like those other movies, you have to go see it, which should bring us to 1938.
1938, the best picture was You Can't Take It With You. It was a pretty good choice at first glance, but not when Bringing Up Baby was released the same year, a much better film in the same genre. Actually, it's my favorite, and my pick for the best film of 1938. The other good choices, though, would have been The Lady Vanishes and The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Today, I don't think anyone would argue with Bringing Up Baby as the best picture from that year. 1939
was a very famous year. It's considered the best year Hollywood ever had. And there are just so many titles, and I had such a hard time. I had the hardest time picking a best film from this year. The best picture, however, the Oscar race itself wasn't actually, I suspect, that close. It was Gone with the Wind. It was just a sensation at the time. And more than that, I think The Wizard of Oz was securely in second place. But today, when we're looking back on these, and they are great, but look at the others. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Midnight, Le Jour Se Lève, The Rules of the Game, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, The Roaring Twenties, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Of Mice and Men, Ninotchka, Wuthering Heights, Stagecoach, The Women, Beau Jest, Gunga Din, Dark Victory, Only Angels Have Wings, and I will take a deep breath now. Any of those would have been really reasonable choices. It's such a tough choice. I think the critics probably would choose The Rules of the Game at this point. If I had to pick, there's really a photo finish here. I could be persuaded differently, just on a different mood.
Okay, I'm going to stay out of that because it's just too close to call, which I guess wraps up this segment. Is that right?
Yeah, we'll continue doing this about a decade at a time over the next several episodes, so tune back in then. Last week, our top six list topic was movies you thought would be bad but turned out to be good. As a compliment, this week's top six is movies that you were disappointed in when you went to see them. We do top six lists because six is one less than seven. Stephen, it's interesting that most of the time our top six lists are about the movies themselves, but I think last week and this week, our choices are really more about our personal relationships with the movies and our expectations for them.
Absolutely, which is going to need some explaining when I get to my number one because I'm embarrassed by it, but what are you going to do?
Okay. By the way, I defy you to name the same number one movie for the third week in a row.
I'm afraid that, I should, but I just okay, quick get around to it.
Okay. Well, this brings me to my number six pick, which is from 1993. It's actually the least recent film on my list. I'm not sure if that's because older movies are more well-known, you're less likely to be surprised by the level of quality, or if we've just gotten really good over the years at underachieving. Anyway, my number six is called, well, I'm embarrassed to say it too, it's Cliffhanger, an action movie starring Sylvester Stallone that's all about mountain climbing in the Rockies and the heist and terrorists and stuff like that. I can't remember now why I thought it would be good, but I definitely remember being sorely disappointed. It's a terrifically stupid movie, merrily ignoring common sense and the laws of physics at every turn. Even if you've checked your brain at the door, you are still smarter than this movie. And it's not even that exciting on a visceral level, it's just kind of brutal and dumb.
Yeah, that brutal and dumb, that pretty much sums up most of Stallone's career. My number six movie, however, is sort of a classic, and that is La Ventura, the 1960 film by Michelangelo Antonioni. It's sort of a very well-respected movie, considered a classic by many critics. And before I saw it, I had seen Antonioni's 1966 film, Blow Up, which I loved. And so I was really hyped to see La Ventura, and then it turned out to be 6 hours of characters just walking around aimlessly. I understand that allegedly the movie gets better as you get older, so maybe in 40 years I'll love it, but for me it was just, I wouldn't say it was a bad movie, but just a huge disappointment.
I can definitely understand where that perception comes from. I think we're both thinking in particular of Roger Ebert, who famously did not like this movie when it came out, saw it 10 or 20 years later and thought, well, it's interesting ideas but doesn't quite gel, and has only just recently changed his mind and featured it on his Great Movies series. But that same sort of story has happened with a lot of other critics, and I can feel it happening with me already. It's not been a lot of years since I saw it by any means, but definitely when I saw it, I was really just agonized. It was tough to get through, and now in my mind, in retrospect, I sort of appreciate what it was doing. So, I don't know, it's a weird one, definitely. My number five follows on the heels of Airplane, The Naked Gun, Top Secret, and Hot Shots. I liked all those, but I haven't seen a good comedy in that style since those were made. And the turning point was Spy Hard from 1996. At the time, there really hadn't been many failures at this kind of comedy, and I'm a fan of the James Bond series and Die Hard and James Cameron's True Lies, so I figured this parody would work for me. Well, when I saw it, I learned all about how you can make a bad movie in this subgenre, and definitely they got worse as they kept trying to churn them out. Looking back, the fact that the Zucker brothers and Jim Abrahams were not involved probably should have tipped me off, but actually, they never made a good comedy of this sort again, either.
I'm not really sure how good most other movies are. I like the Naked Gun movies, but Hot Shots and Spy Hard, I could leave her. Anyway, my number five film is a pretty recent movie. It's Ocean's 12, the follow-up to Ocean's 11 by Steven Soderbergh. And this was made in 2004, and at that time, Soderbergh was still pretty hot. I think he's maybe cooled down a little bit, but I loved Ocean's 11, and I absolutely love heist movies, and I was really psyched for this, and I went and saw it in the theater, and disappointed to find out no actual heists in this movie. In fact, most of the heists that are going to occur end up not occurring or occurring entirely off-camera, and the entire thing is just Soderbergh playing around with style, which maybe I could have gotten behind had I not been in the mood for a heist flick.
Yeah, I like the movie, but it's definitely one that you need to have the correct expectations for. My number four, I thought it would look pretty good. It was called America's Sweethearts from 2001, and it looked like it was going to be a smart satire of Hollywood publicity and celebrity news and tabloids and all that kind of thing. And it starred some actors I really like, John Cusack in particular, Billy Crystal, Julia Roberts, and Catherine Zeta-Jones. As it turned out, this was about as clever as a bad sitcom, with really juvenile humor and not much else, and it's not even all that pleasant. I mean, really all there is here is a bunch of characters being nasty to each other, so, yay.
Yeah, I know that had a great cast list, but I didn't really get too psyched up for it, fortunately, but I can understand why you'd be disappointed with it. My number four movie, probably most people listening would pick this as one of their very top movies, but I'm kind of torn on it. It's The Phantom Menace, of course, 1999 by George Lucas, and I'm going to go ahead and come out here and say that I actually like this movie. I think it's a good movie. It's not as good as the other Star Wars films, but of course, in 1999, we were all expecting the second coming of Star Wars, and we just got a movie that was actually worse than Return of the Jedi. And while it's not really, I know a lot of people hate it, but I think it's entertaining. It's just, it's not really a great movie by any means, and it's such a letdown after 20-some years of hype.
Absolutely. For me, I loved Return of the Jedi. I don't really follow the common belief that that is substantially weaker than the other two. When I saw The Phantom Menace, though, I was thrilled. I thought, this is great, and it actually took me a little while to realize, oh, you know, you come off the adrenaline high, I guess, and then realize
yeah,
it's
here.
Not so exciting. I'm definitely with you, though. I'm not in the camp that just hates it and thinks it's the worst movie ever. I think all three of the prequels are generally good movies. It's just that we were all expecting better, and I suppose there's really no way to live up to that. Anyway, moving on to my number three, he's sort of gone out of fashion these days, prone to overdo things, and until recently was definitely overexposed, but I like Robin Williams. I think he's both good in comedies and in dramas. I also like Billy Crystal, and he's just so likable it's hard not to smile when he's performing. So when I heard they were going to team up for a movie called Father's Day, I was looking forward to it. Alas, poor me.
Oh.
Yeah, Father's Day is retchingly, unrelentingly unfunny. It's so unfunny that it sucked laughs away from the previous comedies I had watched. There's just no material here for them to perform. What little story there is just mind-numbingly sappy, unconvincing soap operatic drama about finding a kid that's run away and each of the men thinks it's his son, and it bounces from one pseudo-sentimental scene after another, and in between are attempts at humor. It just fails miserably. This is horrid.
Yeah, it's pretty much pure suck. I watched half of it. Half of it. So my number three film is probably one that people are going to also be upset at me for, but it's Brazil, the 1985 film by Terry Gilliam. I kind of like Brazil, but not as much as most people do, and I jumped on the Gilliam bandwagon a little late. I actually saw Brazil after I had seen 12 Monkeys, and I think 12 Monkeys is an absolute sci-fi classic. And so when I saw Brazil, while I appreciated a lot of the design, the story and the characters really, really left me flat, and I couldn't appreciate it like everyone else has, apparently, and I was expecting another, you know, absolutely masterwork, and pretty disappointed by it.
I think I'm kind of in between you and the Gilliam fans. I thought it was pretty great. Maybe not the classic, definitely not the classic that 12 Monkeys is. I love that scene, though, where they're in little cubicles and they have to share a desk that goes through the wall. That was a really nice touch. My number two, well, by 1998, producer Jerry Bruckheimer was on a hot streak with big blockbusters. Crimson Tide, The Rock, and Con Air were the previous three, and I liked or loved all of them. And his next was going to be Armageddon. And it was going to have Bruce Willis, who's great in action movies, and Steve Buscemi, who's great in everything. And it was going to be directed by Michael Bay, whose only movie I was familiar with at that time was The Rock, and I loved that. So my expectations were high for this one, and I was shocked! When Roger Ebert's review came out and it was one star. I could scarcely believe it. But when I saw it, I could only agree. Right from the very beginning, there's an early scene on an oil rig and Bruce Willis plays the protective father and takes a shotgun and chases Ben Affleck away from his daughter. And I don't know that I can think of a less convincing scene in a big movie. It really just looked like actors imitating behavior that didn't really make any sense at all. The acting and staging just totally failed to sell this. And then things progress and the action scenes start firing up and they're so terrible. Michael Bay seems to think you have to cut every half second or more, whether you need to or not, and the result is that some action scenes are just impossible to follow what's happening, and if you don't know what's going on, how can there be tension? The few times this movie does slow down, it still cuts ridiculously, so you don't get the juxtaposition of fast and slow that makes both paces effective. And then there are these absurdly overwritten, overscored speeches, whether it's Billy Bob Thornton giving a contrived pep talk or Bruce Willis giving this contrived farewell speech. It's just so artificial. It's almost insulting that the filmmakers expect you to buy into this nonsense.
You know, I've only ever seen Armageddon in French, and I think it's probably better that way. You know, I got another science fiction film. Pretty much, I think most of my, two-thirds of my list are sci-fi movies, and that's The Matrix Revolutions from 2003. I think I've mentioned on this show before how Matrix Revolutions, I was so excited for it because I loved Reloaded and I loved The Matrix, and I was expecting Revolutions to explain everything, and I hated Revolutions so much that I stopped liking Reloaded. It was like you mentioned Father's Day, sucking the laughs out of previous films. This just sucked everything I like out of Reloaded out. It was some sort of retroactive sucking. And I find pretty much nothing good about Revolutions. And I remember about 5 minutes into it, I just like looked at my brother with whom I was watching the movie and said, oh, we gotta get out of here. But unfortunately, we stayed and things got worse.
I think that movie has the worst death scene of any I've ever seen. I definitely agree. I loved Reloaded. I thought it was as good, maybe even better than the original, but, you know, it just doesn't have a conclusion. Anyway, my number one is called Wild Wild West from 1999. I was excited about this movie for over a year before its release because it just seemed like the perfect collaboration of great talents. Let me explain. It was going to be this big summer movie at a time, and there seemed to be a lot of really good summer movies, like The Mask of Zorro and Contact and so on, Armageddon notwithstanding. And the director was Barry Sonnenfeld, one of my absolute favorite directors at that time. As far as I was concerned, he'd never made a bad movie. I loved The Addams Family, I loved Men in Black, I really loved Get Shorty. Addams Family Values was only okay, but that was a sequel, so, you know, so what? Anyway, the cast was going to be fantastic. Also, Will Smith, fresh off Men in Black, which I loved. You know, he was the king of summer movies at this time. Kevin Kline, one of my favorite comic actors ever since the Pirates of Penzance and A Fish Called Wanda. Kenneth Branagh, the director and star of one of my favorite thrillers, Dead Again. How could this go wrong? Even if the movie wasn't great, surely it was going to be immensely entertaining to watch. These actors at work, and also Sonnenfeld's trademark sweeping tracking shots that are quite enjoyable just by themselves. And inexplicably, it's just one of the worst movies imaginable. None of the jokes work, none of the action work. They might have just, you know, they might have projected the movie backwards for all the sound and noise and movement affected me. It was torturous and so disappointing after all that time of anticipating it.
What about the giant mechanical spider? How awesome is that?
Shut up.
I'm not sure who's more embarrassing, your number one or mine, but my number one is Stargate from 1994, directed by that hack Roland Emmerich. And it's inexplicable. For some reason, in 1994, Stargate was the movie I wanted to see. It was one of those movies where, you know, a month out, I was thinking, 4 weeks until Stargate. Stargate opens in 3 weeks. Stargate's coming. And then, it's terrible. I think I'm just a sucker for science fiction films. I always expect them to be good, and I love them when they are. And inevitably, they disappoint me. And Stargate, it's my own fault, really, because it was clearly a stupid action movie. But for some reason, I thought it was going to be like an intelligent science fiction movie about Stargates. I don't know. It was pretty dumb of me, but it turned out to be a big, dumb action movie with very few redeeming qualities. Though, strangely, people like it, and there's a TV show and stuff, but I'm still so upset about how disappointing Stargate was to me that I've never gotten around to actually checking that stuff out.
Yeah, supposedly the TV show is a lot better. I haven't seen it myself. Yeah, but definitely the movie. This was another one I was also anticipating kind of highly, and it didn't seem to get thrashed too much on the reviews even, but definitely when I saw it, I just was like, what is going on and why do I care? Gosh. You know, and since then, no other Roland Emmerich movie has disappointed me because I've just learned not to get too excited. I actually did like Independence Day, unlike some people, but definitely nothing there.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing I think would be interesting, this is kind of a fun topic because it does, like you said, gives insight into the person and not just the film. So I think maybe one thing we want to do is solicit listeners to come on the website and maybe give us some ideas of the movies that disappointed you and why.
Absolutely.
I think it's a great thing that speaks to how we interact with film.
Yeah, we'll open up a special area for you to talk about that there. And the website is?
AllMovieTalk.com. It's the name of the show. If you know the name of the podcast, you know the name of the website.
Yep, very easy to remember. So to recap real quick, Stephen, what was your top six?
My number six was the classic film La Ventura from 1960, the not-so-classic Ocean's 12 from 2004, the hated Phantom Menace from 1999, the very celebrated Brazil from 85, Matrix Revolutions from 2003, which I don't have an adjective about, and the just complete and total garbage Stargate from 1994. Screw you, Roland Emmerich.
It's interesting we're coming up with a few good movies that were disappointing all the same. I think all of mine are bad, though. Number six, Cliffhanger from 1993. Number five, Spy Hard from 1996. Number four, America's Sweethearts from 2001. Number three, Father's Day from 1997. Number two, Armageddon from 1998. And number one, Wild Wild West from 1999.
And remember, just check out the website, allmovietalk.com, and give us the movies that disappointed you. You know, we've all been there. You're tired after dealing with some, you know, problem at home and just making your way into the job that you hate when all of a sudden the car behind you blows up. Some men in body armor and ski masks are demanding that you give them some secret code that you don't know, yada, yada, yada. Look.
That ruins my whole day.
I know. And you know what it means? It means that at least for the next week, you're stuck in an action movie. And unless you play your cards right, you could very well die or get seriously injured. So we're going to do a service here at All Movie Talk and give you an idea of how to survive an action movie should you find yourself in one, which is quite common. This does happen to people all the time. I think far and away the most important thing to survive an action movie is to make sure that you're the hero. The last thing you want to do is be a sidekick or supporting character, especially if you're a minority, by the way. I mean, if you're an ethnic minority, you want to make sure you're the hero because minority sidekicks do not have a very high survival rate. So what you want to do is pretty much suppress any like really weird personality quirks that you have, because those are giveaways of sidekickness. You need to be kind of stoic and cynical. You can make one-liners, but only after you kill dudes. You don't want to be constantly cracking jokes, because, you know, that's comic relief, and comic relief is sidekick.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to be a super geeky computer nerd?
No. You know, you might be able to survive if you can be the guy who's back at the base talking to the hero through an earpiece, but probably what's going to happen is you're going to get taken hostage and then killed to escalate the moral drama, the emotional drama for the hero. You don't want to get killed just so the hero has a real reason to beat the bad guys. That happens a lot. You don't want to get killed at the end of the second act, because that's pretty common. The next thing you want to do to be the hero is you got to take charge. You don't want to say things like, if we don't save ourselves, no one will. Instead, you know, want to think proactive, you know. You're going to make those bastards pay if it's the last thing I do. That's what you want to be thinking about. You don't want to be, like, trying to work together. You want to be the guy who's tough and in charge. If anyone else tells you how crazy the plan is, this is where you got to have a witty comeback. Let's talk about phrases such as, don't tell me the odds, or it's the only plan we've got. Those are what make you the hero. Now, if you're, for some reason, really physically unattractive, you can't be the hero. It's just bad news. What you want to do is stay indoors, and you want to be the guy, like I said, who's back at base, talking to the hero through the cell phone or whatever. Just stay the heck away from any dangerous situations. Don't certainly ever put yourself anywhere near harm's way, because you will die. There's one other thing, that if you're a hot chick, you could definitely have it made without being the hero. You can be the love interest who doesn't die. You gotta dress the part. This means a tank top and a pair of tight jeans in most cases for the hot chicks. Because if you're too sexy, a lot of times you're gonna get killed. You wanna be kinda like rough and still hot. That's the important thing.
But you can be immoral all you want, right?
No. See, no? You have to be ultimately moral. Because if you're the evil chick, you're gonna get killed as well. That's bad news. So, you also need to know a bit about combat, because fighting and killing is part and parcel of surviving an action movie. And despite whatever, you know, fake documentaries you've seen on the History Channel or read about in war textbooks, whatever, body armor and assault rifles are worthless. Nobody actually uses them to get things done. Street clothes, or possibly a nice tuxedo, and a handgun are your real best bets. Basically, the smaller the gun, the more accurate and deadly it is, with a few exceptions. Armies around the world use M16s and AK-47s, but everyone knows they can't hit anything with a rifle. What you want is a semi-auto handgun. Maybe if you're really, really into it, you can get a nice revolver. That can be pretty cool. A big 357 or something, or maybe a pearl-handled revolver that's some sort of antique to give you a bit of personality. But probably your best bet is to go with, you know, a nice handgun with good stopping power. If you're real macho dude, you pretty much stuck with the Desert Eagle 50 cal. That's as good as an anti-tank gun, really. It'll kill anything. And full body armor, total waste of time. You survive action movies by dodging bullets, and body armor just slows you down. So let's say you hear a gunshot. Duck, roll, jump, leap. You have plenty of time. And bullets travel much slower than sound, so once you hear the gunshot, you have plenty of time to get out of the way. Don't worry about it. You know, really, assault rifle fire is pretty easily avoided. The only guys who get killed are those guys who just stand there when the guns start shooting. You don't want to be the guy with the body armor with your assault rifle firing at a guy who's rolling around, because the guy who's rolling around will kill you in no time, because you're not rolling.
I would say that you should have one element of body armor, and that is a cigarette lighter that your dad gave you in your pocket.
Alternatively, a pocket Bible. Also fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah, any sort of, like, memento that you can keep in your shirt pocket right above your heart, that'll save your life. Bullets are actually stopped pretty easily by mementos, much less easier by Kevlar. I think that's a common misconception people have. There's one exception, though. You can wear a bulletproof vest if you put your street clothes over it and you walk into a situation where the villain is planning to kill you and you know it. So you'd wear that flak jacket underneath your t-shirt. And, you know, I mean, bulletproof vests, not bulky at all. You slap a Hanes t-shirt over it, you're good to go. No one will see it. Now, the villain's going to shoot you. They don't ever bother to shoot you in the face or the head. They're going to always shoot you center mass right in the chest. You'll fall down. The villains, you know, they're not that sharp. They don't ever look for blood or anything like that. They'll accept that you're dead once you've fallen down after they shot you in the chest. You'll be a little dazed, but otherwise you're fine. But that's the only time that Butt Hammer's going to do anything for you. Otherwise, you can just discard it. And, of course, when you do discard it, be sure that you pull your shirt off first and check out the place where the bullet impacted the vest. That's, I don't know why, it's just cool, you gotta do it. And you also be willing to kill anyone. You should know, when it comes to hand-to-hand combat, that being punched doesn't really hurt that much. You can get punched in the face or the gut all day long without getting a little more than dizzy. If you want to finish somebody off, you can't just punch them to death. That's not gonna work. what you want to do is have a fist fight in an abandoned factory, because that kind of setting gives you plenty of chances to kill your opponents. Think about it, you got, like, hooks, you got chains, you got old factory machinery. That's the kind of stuff that works. You know, punching people, choking them out, worthless.
Even shooting them doesn't work.
Oh, yeah, that's...
And you should not assume... Because the bad guy's going to shoot you and not realize that you have the bulletproof vest on. You don't want to make that same mistake. The villain does not have the bulletproof vest, but it still won't kill him.
Yeah, because... Well, it's so hard to hit people, too. Because, I mean, all you got to do is duck and roll a little bit. What are you going to do? You got to get up close and finish them off with something cool. Just punch them, it's never going to work. The one exception, if you sneak up behind somebody, you can break their neck in pretty much, you know, a half a second flat. It's easy to do and guaranteed kill if you sneak up on it. This will never work on real villains, just on those poorly trained military personnel. Now, you got to kill more than just people. You got to blow stuff up. So, some notes about vehicles. Blowing up cars is super easy. You just shoot their fuel tanks, and it'll just explode immediately. If you don't know where the fuel tank is on a car, just guess. It's a little-known fact, actually 75% of every car is devoted to carrying very explosive fuel. This is why gasoline costs so much, because cars just blow up constantly if that fuel tank is even punctured a little bit. Now, like a big trailer truck, like a semi, those are a little bit harder. In order to destroy one of those, you got to get something in its way. This will cause the driver to brake suddenly, and the truck will swerve over, the trailer will tip, and they'll fishtail, and then while the truck is overturned, bam! You can shoot the undercarriage with your handgun, whole thing goes up in flames, because of course the entire undercarriage of a big tractor trailer like that is once again devoted to carrying fuel. I mean, they gotta carry it somewhere, and it's not in the cab, it's in the undercarriage. But also be aware that, you know, that trailer that they're hauling around, probably that's got jet fuel in it. Most trailer trucks carry around nothing but fuel in those big tanker trailers, so that will explode and it will be big. So you want to make sure that you're on the ground. Think about it, when you're in school and they do the earthquake drills, stop, duck, and cover. That's the best way to survive explosions. Now, helicopters, they're also harder. They have two basic weaknesses you need to know about. The first, of course, is our good old friend, the fuel tank. You can shoot it out with a handgun, you know, obviously, and the chopper will either blow up or crash from lack of fuel, but then it can be hard to do because the fuel tanks on helicopters aren't quite as big. You gotta have a real good shot toward the back of the body and near the tail somewhere, probably you'll hit the fuel tank. But if it's coming at you straight up, you're not gonna be able to because it's, you know, got the guns ablazing and there's that cockpit and stuff. So what you wanna do is you gotta shoot the pilot. You're gonna use a handgun for this. Don't mess around with those sniper rifles and that kind of nonsense. Get your handgun. And this is one time where you can actually just stand up straight and blam, blam, one or two in the face, pilot's done, helicopter falls. And don't mess around with rockets and that kind of nonsense unless you don't have any more ammo for the handgun. Because it's just too much work, really. You know, you're probably not going to hit it anyway. You're better off, of course, with the most accurate long-range weapon ever invented, the handgun. Now, tanks, you cannot actually defeat with your trusty Desert Eagle. They're one of the few things that won't go down that quickly. You're going to need explosives. Now, I mean, if you don't have any grenades, you can always improvise a sticky bomb from a tube sock and some gasoline. This is pretty easy to do, but it's a last resort. You don't want to walk around without any socks, do you? Because if you don't have socks and shoes, I guarantee you, you're going to be stepping on broken glass or rusty nails or something bad. So, it's better to just grab a grenade off one of those generic soldiers that you always have to kill. Just grab that, throw it inside the tank. Pretty much the way to get a bomb or a grenade of any sort into a tank is you just run up to the roof of the tank, open the unlocked hatch, toss your grenade in, and jump back. Boom. Easy to do. I recommend it. I've done it, you know, many times myself. Now, there's some more exotic craft you might have to fight. A speedboat or a starfighter, for instance. These are a lot tougher. You're not going to be able to take these down with conventional weapons. You're going to make them crash into something. You're not likely to have to fight either of these unless they're chasing you. So what you want to do is you want to go right into a minefield or an asteroid field, depending. You don't want to take the speedboat into the asteroid field because they just don't maneuver that well in space. But something that's difficult to maneuver around. You're going to run straight for the mine or the asteroid or the pier or whatever it is and then turn away at the last second. The person tailing you, they don't have those good response times because they're not heroes. They're just going to crash and burn right behind you. And that's how you get rid of someone who's following you in one of those exotic crafts. Also, you should know that as good as explosives are for destroying vehicles like tanks and other inanimate objects, they're worthless. They're just as bad as an M16 in terms of killing people. You want to use them to blow up things or to make cover for yourself, some smoke and fire. That's great, but you're not going to use it as a primary means of killing anyone. The one exception is a bomb that has a digital countdown. These will kill people. If you come across one, you either have to get the heck out of there or you have to defuse the bomb. Defusing bombs is kind of tricky. First of all, you can't defuse a bomb unless there's less than a minute left on the digital countdown. It has to be, 58 seconds, 55, and getting down there. That's when you start. Because if you start at 10 minutes, it's going to go. You're not going to get it done. I almost guarantee you that. Especially if you're not sure you're the hero. You don't want to be the guy who dies trying to defuse the bomb. This is bad, especially if you're the tech guy. You don't want to get stuck defusing a bomb because it's going to go off. Because you're going to do something foolish because you're not the hero. Like trying to defuse it when there's plenty of time. And what should happen is you're going to cut the wrong wire. And all of a sudden it's going to start counting down even faster and hit zero. And boom, you're dead and the hero now has to avenge your death. You don't want to be in that situation. Now, it also sometimes occurs that you want to recruit other people. This is kind of chancy. I find it's best, really, to just go alone. Like, if you're faced with a task of taking down the head of Chicago's biggest crime syndicate, you might be tempted to call the cops. At best, this is sort of a 50-50 kind of deal. You might be able to get the one lone detective who's clean, but most likely, all the boys down at the precinct houses are in the pocket of the crime boss. And as soon as you talk to that corrupt police captain, he's going to have the car of goons over to murder you while you wait for help. Don't do that. You especially don't want to call the feds. Those guys are both evil and incompetent. You want to go with somebody who might be reliable, is smaller police departments. The one lone sheriff in the town, yeah, he's probably going to get killed helping you out, but he will be a vital assistance. He might distract the bad guys long enough for you to get a shot off. And, of course, anyone with a rank above detective is totally worthless. The brass are always in on it. What's a better idea is to recruit a rogues gallery from the underworld. People who used to work for the crime lord, or mercenaries, and maybe even the occasional random civilian who for some reason got caught up in this whole crazy mess. What you want to do is look for people that have, at most, one or two specific but useful traits. Spies, computer hackers, explosive experts, thieves, hot chicks, karate masters, all those are good types to recruit. But you should be aware, that once you have a team, one person's going to betray you, and at least one will die. It's important to be the hero, because somebody on the team always dies. And so when you do get betrayed by the hot chick or the shifty kid, it's not going to be you who gets killed, it's going to be one of your sidekicks who has to suffer and sacrifices himself to save you. Once you are betrayed, what you want to do is make sure that you threaten your betrayer with death for doing it. It's not going to really do anything, but it sounds cool. And again, the whole key to surviving an action movie is being the hero, and the key to being the hero is to be cool.
Earlier in the podcast, I have this vague memory of asking a trivia question, so we should probably answer that now. The question was, when did silent screen star Lillian Gish make her last movie? Got a guess?
I believe it's sometime, is it 50-something? I think the film is probably Night of the Hunter.
Okay, well, the answer is in the 1980s.
Really?
Yeah, 1987 specifically. She was actually quite active throughout most of her life, taking most of the 30s and the 70s off, but otherwise sustaining a presence in the movies and on television right up until 1987, and ultimately she died in 1993. Her last movie was called The Whales of August, and she shared the lead with Betty Davis, and although her career is overshadowed by her work in the silent years, this is an exceptionally respected performance with a lot of depth to it, and it earned her a Best Actress nomination from the Indie Spirit Awards. At 93 years old when she made this, she's reportedly, how do you judge these things, but reportedly the oldest actress ever to star in a lead performance in a movie. Now, there's an interesting anecdote about this movie. Just after a take, director Lindsay Anderson complimented her, saying she had done a great job with a particular close-up, and Betty Davis said she should. She invented them.
We have a question from one of our listeners who goes by the handle Lazora, and she asks us, just out of curiosity, how much of a queue of episodes do you have? Meaning, how much have we pre-recorded? How far in advance have we got it? Well,
I'd like to know this is all live, as I've mentioned before.
It is all live.
It's a live podcast.
Bearing that in mind, we can't answer that exactly, because what we do is we record segments individually and then assemble them into episodes much later in the process. But since we began, we've had about 10 episodes worth of backlogged material. And so here we are in episode 8, and you haven't even heard half of our material yet. Some of it was recorded before we even started airing. And, that kills us because we're just super excited about what we've got coming, and a lot of it is just going to take a while to roll out. But we'll get it all to you eventually, one episode at a time. And it's all live. Well, that's about it for episode 8. I hope you enjoyed yourself. If you want to help us out, and we'll help you out too by giving you more great entertainment, then go to our website, allmovietalk.com. And there's a bunch of stuff going on there all the time, a new post almost every day, and definitely some good conversation we'd love to have you participate in. When you're done there, go to rankworks.com, rankworks.com, where there's a bunch of movie reviews and a film lover's checklist and some humor-related features that are about movies. Go check all that stuff out.
Of course, we're also back next Tuesday, November 28th, with a new episode. We're going to start off the episode with a discussion of The Prestige, a recent movie that ties in with something back from episode 1. We're going to continue our Best Of series and look at the 1940s. We're also going to spotlight a director who directed one of the most acclaimed French movies of recent years, as well as an installment in the Alien movie series, which is a pretty strange filmography for a director to have. Probably a lot of you know who we're talking about, but if you don't, be sure and tune in next Tuesday for more information.
Cut and print it.